Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hey everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars,
the podcast that takes you from every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I am Ryan.
And you almost nailed it.
No, what word did I miss?
The show that takes you.
No!
And I guess it doesn't really matter, but I think show allows it, so like, if we ever do go video.
That's true.
We don't have to completely rebrand.
Yeah, you're right. It would be, show. That makes sense.
That was a joke. We wouldn't have to rebrand.
That's fine.
We would just have to.
We're going to redo this anyways.
Oh, okay.
This doesn't go live.
You're right. You're right. But hey, welcome back, everybody, to the, what is this, the second movie of?
Third.
Technically third.
Yeah.
If you count our Patriot Lost Media episode.
Yep.
Pretty excited today for this one. It's a musical.
It is a musical, and it's not just a musical. It's actually pretty historic. It's the first all-talk musical that was produced by Hollywood.
Which is so wild to think about, musicals coming out that weren't all talk.
You know, it's I said something to you. I can't remember if it was off or on podcast, but there's something about the indomitable human spirit to where, like, studios, producers alike heard, hey, we can start making talkies now. And they're like, that's amazing. Well, what do you guys want to do first? We should do outdoor westerns and musicals.
Yeah.
That's insane.
It is so ambitious.
Extremely ambitious. And, you know, I think it pays off sometimes, and I think it doesn't pay off in others. We'll talk about that. And I mean that kind of across the board, right? We talked about in Old Arizona how any outdoor scenes looked incredible, but sounded very poor because they couldn't just keep the microphone above them at all times when they're running around,
right?
So amazing that it was on location, but not the optimal experience for the first time that a camera is being used, or a microphone. I keep doing that. So the musical, it's a similar situation. We'll get into how we thought it fared with this, but specifically, we should probably talk about the movie itself. I realize we haven't even said the name yet. So we're talking about The Broadway Melody.
Right.
Which you can also find by the name of The Broadway Melody of 1929. Do you know why that is, Kyle?
Yeah. There were three sequels after this one. So I don't know if originally it was The Broadway Melody of 1929. Maybe it was because they anticipated doing more, but there's The Broadway Melody of 1929, 1936, 1938, and 1940.
Well, and here's my point. This isn't like us saying, you know, this is the Running Man of 1982 or whatever it was, and the Running Man of 2025. That's the name. That's the title.
Right.
The Broadway Melody of 1929, and proper for the others. So I just confused. I feel like it could have just been, you know, Broadway Melody remade, but just continue that. Okay. I haven't seen the others, so I don't know if it like continues the story or if it's just a full remake.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. It'd be weird if they were remaking the same movie that frequently.
Yeah.
Like those three sequels are all 2 years apart.
Right.
So
is the Broadway Melody changing that much?
Yeah. No, I have no idea.
But, so this is our first true musical that we've covered on the show.
Yeah, it's our first musical in general.
That's true. All talky, at least.
All talking. Was there a musical we covered that?
Oh, that we covered. No, oh. Sorry. I meant in general. But that we covered, no.
But let's talk cast and crew.
Yeah.
So The Broadway Melody of 1929 was directed by Harry Beaumont, and it starred Bessie Love as Hank Mahoney, Anita Page as her sister, Queenie Mahoney, and Charles King as Eddie Kearns.
Let's go back to Bessie for a second.
Please.
Hank is her name. There is this sibling dynamic that's introduced pretty early on between the sisters. That would be Queenie and Hank. And it's established pretty quickly that Queenie is the brains of the operation. She has a lot of talent, and she's the brains.
You got it backwards.
Oh, you're so right. I do have it backwards. Sorry, I was going off the names. So Hank is the brains of the operation, right? She is very talented. She knows what she's doing. She kind of heads up operations. Queenie, per Hank's description, is very lucky that she's so pretty, right? So she just is kind of there. It bums me out that her parents, either their parents, would look at them and be like, oh, she's such a Queenie. And then look at the other one and be like, Hank, I guess. And in our research, it didn't come clear in the movie. They may have said, and I may have missed it, which is very easy to do with these microphones that aren't picking up everything. But they say have her name as Harriet. And you and I even like discussed, if it was Henrietta, maybe we could pick up Hank from that.
Right.
But from Harriet, I'm not really getting Hank. Maybe that was an of its time thing.
Yeah, I have no idea. That being said, I like Hank as a girl's name.
Well, she has the spirit of a Hank.
Yeah.
Right? Of just kind of like, let me at him kind of type of personality. So she is a Hank in that regard. I just don't think that her parents saw her having like a very strong-willed personality and be like, oh, that's a Hank.
Yeah.
Like, imagine me doing that to my kid and like, she's three and I see her have like a feisty spirit. I'm like, we're changing your name to like Edward. Right. We're going to do something that has a little bit of fire behind it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's, but the name definitely fits the character because like you said, she's got that fire. She's constantly throwing out some pretty solid one-liners.
Yeah.
In a, whenever she gets into an argument with either Queenie or Eddie or the other girl that is like the whole movie trying to sabotage their performance.
Yep.
She's great. She's a lot of fun. Very much a Hank.
Very much a Hank. Of course, those two are paired with Eddie, Eddie Kearns, who is a Hollywood, Broadway rather, a Broadway writer.
Yes.
Musician, performer, all of the above.
All of the above.
Yep. And in the movie specifically, he has written a piece called The Broadway Melody, and he has sold it to Zenfield. So Zenfield is a producer who puts on these plays, the musicals, and that's going to happen. Broadway Melody is a surefire thing, and he's bringing in the sisters, appropriately, Hank and Queenie, to perform in it because he's known them for so long, and he has kind of a thing going with Hank.
Right, right. That's the plot of the movie.
That's it.
The end.
That's it.
There's not a whole lot of substance here. There's some like love triangle drama. Shout out to Wings, the OG love triangle.
Well, they try to do a love square here.
Oh, wait, who's the fourth one?
Jacques.
Why do I have no memory of Jacques? Well, oh, that's Queenie's.
Yes.
Wow. How could I forget Jacques? He's awful.
It's not a square like traditionally, but there are like four love interests kind of like thrown around in here.
Right.
So do you want to talk about the love interest for a minute?
Yeah, let's do that.
So the love interest for me was confusing because I kind of got from the very beginning that Eddie and Hank were very much, you know, hey, we're interested. Wouldn't it be cool if we made this thing happen? Mm-hmm. It wasn't established like, this is my girl. Like, it was just kind of like, yeah, okay, here she is. And he kisses her. But then he kisses Queenie the same way. So at that point, it's like a customary thing, right? So then there starts to be some like, you know, wow, I haven't seen Queen in a very long time. Wow, she's grown up. She's beautiful. So you start seeing that like, you know, spread there. And then throughout the rest of the movie, it seems like Hank and Eddie's connection is mostly out of just obligation.
Yeah.
Like we said we'd do this, so we should, right? Like that's kind of it. That to me was just absolutely, there was devoid drama for me. Right. Where I was like, you're picking Queenie. What are we doing? Like, if you guys had chemistry and, like, I could see why you're together, totally. That was never apparent to me. I don't know. How'd you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that their relationship, Hank and Eddie's, feels business-related.
Sure.
In a way. She probably, well, I don't want to assume anything, but it seems like maybe she got close because he was a name that could get her into onto the stage, and now they've just kind of hung on to that. And I think the reason for that was to allow for this love triangle, love square, and add this drama, but make it in a way where by the end of the movie, regardless of how things turned out, everything would work out and the three would still be comfortable with each other because it was never that serious of a relationship.
Right. Well, the other thing that we're not mentioning is that this is all happening in New York when the girls have had their uncle, Jed, who's played by an actor named Jed, who has told them that he's secured, what, 300? Like, it was either 30 or 300 shows that he's lined up for them. And
right.
It's ready to go, presumably in California, Hollywood. And they said, nope, we've done this all just so we can get out to New York and make it big here on Broadway. And Eddie is going to be our ticket to do that. And I think you're right. I think Hank sees Eddie a little bit more as that ticket. And Queenie is more like, look at how nice of him to help us out.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why I think for me, I never really pitched the whole, I never put much weight into the relationship between Hank and Eddie.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that's to kind of let you down easy at the end and be like, everybody's happy. It was a happy ending. And I don't feel completely.
It does not feel like everyone got the fair share.
No, it definitely doesn't. But I think it's a happier ending than, I think it's like an old Hollywood happy ending.
Yeah. Where like everyone could be happy.
Yeah. And everybody, all of your main characters are in the same room together at the end.
Yeah, that's fair. So let's talk about the awards side of this, what it was nominated for. So specifically, it was nominated for Outstanding Best Picture, Outstanding Picture, Best Director, which was Harry Beaumont, as you mentioned, and then Best Actress. Do you have any kind of surprise as to which actress was nominated for this?
No.
So it was Bessie Love. Right. So Bessie was nominated for her portrayal as Hank, which is interesting because I kind of think it's a little bit more Queenie's movie than it is Hank's.
Okay.
Right? Queenie is kind of like the morality of the movie. She's the one who, when her sister kind of blows the opportunity that they have with Zanfield, she goes in and makes the deal of, well, hey, hire both of us under my salary. And he's like, well, I can't turn that down. And she's the one who's kind of like trying to make her sister happy and then ultimately has to try and find a way to make herself happy. And she's the one who ends up with Eddie. So to me, it kind of feels like in terms of lead actress, she's up there a little bit more than Hank. So I was a little surprised to see that like nomination wise, Bessie Love has that nomination.
Yeah, but I think it's definitely a movie where you have two leads, lead actresses.
Sure.
And that being said, when it comes to the actual performance, even though it kind of follows Queenie's story more, Anita Page's story, Bessie Love really puts on a solid performance at very specific points of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. The Oscar, not that they did clips back then, but the Oscar clip of her would certainly be after she's admitted that she's not in love with him and Queenie should go after him. And she has that moment, like, putting on her makeup before a show of just, like, breaking down. Like, I get that.
She goes between, like, crying and laughing, and she's almost in hysterics.
Yep.
That's probably one of the most emotional female lead performances we've seen doing the podcast so far.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to deny that, yeah, Bessie Love probably deserved that nomination.
Yeah, and I don't want to diminish that. She certainly deserved it. I was just surprised to see that it wasn't split, especially with the previous entries that we've done here, where we see that they're nominated for multiple things, and movies can be nominated multiple times.
Yeah.
Surprised to see they didn't decide to pull the plug on this and also nominate Queenie's actress.
I'm curious when that first happens historically in the Oscars, that two actors from one movie were nominated.
I guess it hasn't happened already, now that I'm thinking back to this, but it certainly will come a little more recently now in the 2000s than maybe before.
Yeah, but what was the
I'm
first?
Thinking maybe like Philadelphia or something like that might have been a nomination for both.
Dang.
Tom Hanks and Denzel.
Oh, I was thinking the Philadelphia Story from 1940. I was like, was Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart both nominated?
That's a good example, though.
Yeah, I can't remember. I knew at one point, but I guess I should have done my research. Audience, remind me, and I'll look it up and announce it during this year's ceremony episode.
Yes, please.
Thanks, guys.
Make sure you write in. If you don't write in, we're never going to talk about it again.
Yeah, we'll forget it, and we'll only
at
talk
home,
about
they're
it.
Like, everyone don't write in.
Right.
We talked about how it was the very early stages of musicals, right? Mm-hmm. It was not the first ever musical, but it was the first ever all-talk musical. So that means that they're kind of learning how to do this in real time, right? So any ability of how to record, they're figuring that out by trial and error.
Right.
So credit where it's due. Like that's an amazing feat. The downside is that it kind of results in a pretty uneven feeling. Like there are songs, like musical numbers in this, but a lot of them are repeats. You hear the Broadway melody quite a bit.
So many times.
And I kind of liked this movie when it was a satire. Mm-hmm. Like there's a portion of the movie where you're watching the Broadway Melody happening, being put on, and you see a, it's like a Roman gladiator who's like trying to like, he can't sing without the spotlight being on him, even in practice. So he needs a spotlight on him, but there's someone else who wants a spotlight on them at the same time. And there's a little bit between that where it felt very satire of Broadway.
Right.
And I thought that was a really great thing. But beyond that, the songs were just kind of there.
Yeah, they're really not anything to write home about.
I mean, okay, so the setup here is that Eddie tells the girls, like, they've come already to New York. And he's like, look, I got this song. I sold it to Zanfield. We're really excited about it. We're putting it on. You want to hear it? They're like, yeah, you got to play it. He's like, all right, let me play it for you. And he does like 45 seconds of just like the Broadway Melody. And they're like, that is the best thing I've ever heard. Can you do it once more and dance? And he's like, totally. And they do it once more and dance. And it's just, there's nothing quite as bad in a movie when like you're being told that something's amazing. And you're like, that's good.
Right. Yeah.
And then you have to hear it four more times to be like, guys, isn't this amazing? And you're like, it's good. And even like the Broadway level production that they do for the Broadway Melody, when it is Eddie on stage in the suit and all the dancers and everything, it just feels... Here's the thing. This is unfair. This is unfair to the movie because I'm watching what he's doing. And I'm like, hey, this is great. I think Singing in the Rain does it better.
Right.
But like Singing in the Rain got it from this.
We're not there yet.
We're not there yet. So there are versions of this that are done better in the future.
Yeah.
But watching this back now with the technology that they had, it's difficult to connect with these songs.
Yeah. It's so fascinating, too, because there are a lot of times when I can watch an early movie of a genre and kind of disassociate from anything that comes after and be like, okay, this is what is impressive about this particular entry. We did it with The Racket. You know, we were able to find the merits in that movie. In Old Arizona, we could find the merits in that Western movie. That being said, I just like In Old Arizona in general. But
yeah,
as far as this musical goes, it is so hard for me to just detach and look at the movie on its own and the music specifically and be like, okay, I get why people like this. I don't get it. It's really that one Broadway Melody song.
Yep.
I don't think there are any other memorable songs.
So that's the thing is like, we'll get to this later. There's a movie that I may or may not have already mentioned, that has a song that feels like it also kind of lifted from this, but better. And there's a song that the sisters do together called Boyfriend. And it's basically just them holding each other, walking one direction, and then turning around and walking in the other direction.
Yep.
And they're just singing about a boyfriend. It's fine. Like, it's not great. It's not memorable. I couldn't hum it to you right now. At least Broadway Melody, we all know, like, you know, the Broadway Melody. Like, we have that down.
I love that, too.
Right. But the rest of it is just like barely songs. Like I was coming in here ready to prepare to say like, is it really a musical? But there are like musical numbers listed. They're just so much smaller than the Broadway Melody, and that's the majority that's being played. One thing we neglected to say that I did want to bring up to you with the production level of this being kind of like grassroots, they're figuring out while they do it. The opening scene of this movie is in, I guess, like a showroom or a practice room where there's multiple rooms and people are playing different instruments, different songs. Was that a auditory nightmare for you?
No, it wasn't. Because I knew if someone would have started speaking and it was like, hey, you really have to pay attention to what that one guy's saying, that would have been awful. But I think it was just to show the chaos of like the New York music composing and how everybody's working right next to each other to make the next big thing. I think it was effective in what it was trying to present.
Okay, that makes way more sense because I couldn't keep track of who was doing what and like who I was supposed to listen to. Because there are a few moments where there is someone trying to speak while other people are performing where I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
If this is the movie, like I'm concerned. But it was just the beginning, and I'm sure you're right. It was intentional to kind of set the tone of like Broadway in 1920s.
Right, and the chaos that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that being the opening shot, though. When the title credits are rolling, though, it's like helicopter footage of New York City.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
I thought that was very cool. That was something we haven't seen done before.
And it's so wild, because in my mind, I automatically assume either they built a model, or I don't want to say they CGI'd it, but they did something that wasn't actually taking a helicopter into the sky to film it. But they probably took a helicopter up to film that.
They probably did.
It's so weird.
Maybe they just, I don't want to say strapped, but like honestly held the camera.
Yeah.
And then just put it on the plane and just like aimed.
Yeah. That stuff always seems completely out of the question for the time period. But I guess if just a couple years ago we were strapping them to planes for wings. Yeah. They had a helicopter mounted camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you say that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Those words correct. Couple hyphens in there. Yeah, no, I definitely think they did. And I will say that it did kind of set the scene for me of like, you know, the wide, like, it felt like a epic scale that it's trying to portray, which is interesting because the movie is pretty contained. It's mostly a play.
Mostly, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's mostly their apartment, their dressing room, the Zanfield's theater, I guess, and then Jock's apartment. That's a about it. Well, Queenie's apartment.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
And I think that's interesting to bring up In Old Arizona again, that the kind of claustrophobia I felt in this movie because it was all on sound stages and things, it helps to emphasize how wildly dynamic the sets were in Old Arizona.
Yeah.
It being filmed on location and out in the wide open spaces. It really does feel like an open, epic movie. If you can call like a 1929 Western epic?
I think I would. I don't think that it really goes to like the epic distance, but it does feel kind of epic in size.
Yeah, and I imagine for the time period especially, that must have just been like, wow, look at all of this space. I don't know. I felt very claustrophobic
for
the Broadway Melody.
I wonder, too, if in Old Arizona... I think you can all see where our ratings are going with this at the end, but I wonder if within Old Arizona, it felt kind of like they're breaking past the fourth wall, right? Like you've always seen them go in the distance, but now you can actually hear them leaving this space and watch them leave that space. So I wonder if that's more of like, for the audience, it's like they're going somewhere they haven't been before.
Yeah.
They have, but you just have the audio now tricking you into thinking that they're leaving further than you can imagine.
That's true.
So that makes it probably makes it feel a little bit bigger to the movie's credit.
Right.
With this, sound is mostly good. One thing I thought was funny, there's this and another movie we'll talk about here in a little bit that has an issue where the microphone is in one space. And again, these being sound stages, pretty easy to like capture all the audio that you need to. Almost alarmingly well at times. But there's other times where someone's like, oh, let me pick that up for you. And like you hear them walk in the other room and it's just dead silence. And they just like, you see them walk back and then immediately start hearing steps again. You're like, okay, yeah, there's the issue with the cameras or guys, the microphones.
You couldn't see it at home, but Ryan was making little baby steps with his feet.
Yeah, of course, you have it to. Good. You just kind of feel it out. One day we'll be on video and you'll see it all.
Yeah.
We'll have a step that way.
Footage. Well, what did you say?
I said you'll see it all.
Oh, and then not that way. Yeah. Okay.
You'll see the little baby steps. Yeah. I'm a very physical speaker. So... there are some things that stopped Broadway Melody from really like hitting home with me. Mm-hmm. With that said, I did enjoy it. You know, I think that it was very fulfilling to watch, you know, kind of the first ever, I mean, let's just say what it is, the first ever talking musical, full talking musical. Very cool to see that because I like musicals a lot. And I think that there are movies that have gone on to perfect what this tried to do. And I think that they tried to do something before they fully had the technology to fully embrace it. Mm-hmm. And later on, when those projects did do this, they had the technology they needed to fully embrace it. And I think that that's the difference here, is you can't just say, well, yeah, of course, the one that comes after is better. Well, no, there's a reason behind it. So it's not just that, you know, we have to look at the first one and say, well, that's the best. There's ways that can make it not the best.
Right. It's one of those instances, too, where... Initially, my brain says this was nominated because it was the first.
Sure.
But I don't know if you saw, this was also the top grossing film of 1929.
That's crazy.
So this was bringing in the audiences.
Do you know by chance if Eddie Kearns, Bessie Love, or it was Anita, correct?
Anita Page.
Anita Page. Were they or the director like a well-known name that kind of like could bring that on? Or is it really just like a phenomenon?
I would imagine that it was mostly the musical thing that was bringing people in. Because that's what's so weird, too, is because you're in this shift from the silent film to the sound era, even if you have a well-known name, you know them from they're silent films.
True.
So there's no guarantee. I feel like the hype of seeing an actor you know would be more like, oh, let's see what they sound like.
I agree.
But Bessie Love was probably the biggest name attached to the film at the time. Side note, there's a photo of Bessie Love in a Halloween costume that I'm going to post all over the socials. Mm-hmm. She's in a witch outfit. It's one of my favorite photos I've ever found of like old Hollywood stars. And I feel like I post it every year. She's so cute.
Celebrities. They're just like us.
They are. I've never posted a witch costume, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, the night is young. It is only mid-October.
This is true. Man, not when you're listening to it.
That's true.
That's still messing
up. Wow, yeah, brain. That's crazy.
Hope happy you had a Halloween, everybody. And happy Thanksgiving. Still posting that picture, so it'll be there if you want to look back at it.
That old Thanksgiving witch poster.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the camera work. How did this look for you?
You said it before. It's kind of like a play. There wasn't a whole lot that impressed me with the cinematography. The opening, like I said, with the helicopter aerial shots, that was cool. That was surprising. Beyond that, though, I don't know that the blocking or anything was really all that great. And it being a musical with what you assume would be big dance numbers, because that microphone is strapped to one spot.
Yeah.
The dancers are so limited. You said Bessie Love and Nita Page just kind of going back and forth like a Super Mario enemy.
Yeah.
Like, it's, there wasn't a whole lot that thrilled me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, it's, there's some changes that I noticed and I wanted to look it up and I'm very happy that I did that are kind of like, you just barely notice them.
Hmm.
But then there's others where it's just a shot itself, like in Wings, where you're like, how did they do that? So what I thought was impressive about Broadway Melody was that there's a sequence, one of the musical numbers, where I wasn't sure if it was like the version I was watching, but there's a color sequence. Did you catch that?
No.
So there's a color sequence on YouTube, at least. I forget what sequence it is, but specifically, there is color that's put into it. I think it might be The Wedding of the Painted Doll is the name of the sequel or sequence. Sequel. Wow. Yeah. So I looked it up. John Arnold was the cinematographer at the time. So he shot that specific scene with a type of lens. And at the time they're using 35 millimeter.
Okay.
So one sequence was in color. It was presented in an aspect ratio of 1 to 37 to 1. Which is like sound on disc version. And then there's like a sound on film version that he also did. So the red and green filters are kind of the way that you can tell color. Mm. So it's not color proper, but you can definitely tell like there's peach tones and like things you can get from red and green.
Right.
It was a very big production of like, it almost looked like a clamshell on the stage. And there's like faint like tan and brown and like red that kind of comes out of it. And I was very surprised because I was like, well, I know this is 1929, so we're not doing color yet.
Yeah.
So how is this now? So at the time, he tried to do the color, and in back on the back end, there's ways you can do it. But it's really just using the red and green filter to kind of like pop that through Technicolor. It was early two-color Technicolor is what they called it.
Interesting.
So it's interesting, I agree with you, because color was so quickly adopted by musicals, right?
Yeah.
To where musicals had to be very bright and colorful. Again, we'll get there. So it's interesting because it seems like everything that you need, this is the Bible for musicals, because mm-hmm. everything that was done after that is now, you know, used over and over again. So it's cool to see. And I think that's my point in saying all this is that, you know, it may not be the flashiest looking thing, but they are taking their chances. They are doing the grassroots thing. They are figuring this out in real time. Sometimes that's great. Sometimes it's not. I know that they took 3 hours, I think, to film Bessie Love's ukulele scene in the movie.
3 hours is not that much time, really.
Well, I mean, to film a specific sequence that lasts about, like, you know, back then at least.
Yeah.
Right now, like, we're working days to get a shot. But, yeah. like, back then, 3 hours to get this shot of someone playing ukulele.
Yeah.
And you have to drown out the sound of other people, a full orchestra that's playing. It's impressive. And it's still a very impressive movie. I think the way that we have to decide how we want to rank these, though, at least rate them, is if we want to rate them based on how impressive it is now and like how technically achieving it was, or just how entertaining it is as a full product. And I hate saying product, but a full, like, encompassing project.
Right. Yeah, it's so hard. I brought this up to you earlier. When I did the first run of the show,
mm-hmm.
I think I gave this movie like 3.5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody that I follow on Letterboxd that has watched this movie, and even just random people as I'm going through the reviews, everyone was giving it like 1 star. And they're like, yeah, this isn't it. This was not good. I don't know what I liked so much about it before. I do really like Bessie Love and her wit and her comedic dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that Broadway melody, nothing else stuck with me in this movie. So this watch was completely different to me than the first time.
Do you think there's a romanticism for like the first musical, All Talk?
There's
that you had the first time, I mean?
There must have been. There must have been something.
Yeah.
Or maybe I was just in a better headspace and I was like, I love movies. Give them all 4 stars. Like, I don't know what happened. But I'm going through and I'm reading these reviews and I'm like, nobody is saying anything that I disagree with, really.
I'll tell you that I had a very similar experience with it, mostly to the point of what you're saying about how you specifically want to just kind of give them all praise and props.
Yeah.
Because they're just, we love movies. And I got to tell you, you know, this far into the project, I'm not watching anything that I just outright hate, because it is a movie. And like, it is just like, wow, I loved seeing where movies came from and like what we were doing before then. Getting to know actors that I haven't known before in stories that I haven't seen or have seen, and this is where they stem from. It's very cool to be able to do that. So I'm very, you know, humbled by the ability to be able to do this with you. With that said, I think watching this, it was very easy for me to kind of like compartmentalize, hey, wow, this is very cool that it is like the first musical. And I think I walked into it, again, first talking musical, walked into it having that romance and ready to be swept off my feet, right? Mm-hmm. Swept off my feet. And it just didn't happen. And like, I saw everything there. Like, I literally saw the ingredients for everything to sweep me off my feet with a grand musical gesture. And they came up with it and they provided all the things. It just didn't hit for me. And it will go on to hit later on, right? In the years to come with musicals, they will use the exact same thing. The love triangle. The producer who has the show that's just about to take off.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of like Technicolor like popping in these like musical sequences. They have it down. They just didn't do it as well as they could. At the time, they did it as well as they could have.
Right.
But technology was not very much on the side of the adventurous with musicals. So I'm very glad they had it captured. It just doesn't make for a very engaging movie.
We talked about the musical element of it.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about sound in general.
Sure.
And how that's being used in the movies beyond just, okay, people are talking now. We missed it in Old Arizona. We missed it in Old Arizona.
Confusing, I know.
There's a scene where the captain that's on the hunt for the Cisco kid.
Yeah.
He says some kind of joke, and it sounds like he's about to swear, and then a donkey, he honks
cuts
him off.
Well, it's so the moment was when he realizes from the other villager that he had been talking to the Cisco kid.
Yeah.
And he's like, man, he made me feel like, and then like there's a donkey going like, and everything.
Right.
But then he proceeds to make the comment afterwards, too.
Yeah, yeah.
The exact joke.
So I wonder if that was scripted. Or if it just happened.
If it wasn't scripted, that's an incredible bit, because
great donkey.
He just hit the look on his face, like he holds it really well. There's no like smile. If they're smiling, it feels very kind of like, you know, in character.
Yeah.
And then that line delivery is great, and you don't like see anything change with the camera.
Right.
So if anything, class production if that was not scripted.
Yeah.
But yeah, great line, great joke.
Yeah, that's a moment that couldn't have happened in a silent film.
Right.
So They're doing things like that. And there's a moment, not a moment, it's really a character in the Broadway melody that exists in a way that couldn't have if it was still a silent film. And that is Uncle Jed.
So yeah.
He has a stutter. You could present a character with a stutter through title cards, but it would not have the same, I'm doing air quotes here, comedic value that it does in a talking picture. He's played all for laughs.
You know what's great is that he has played all for laughs, but at no point are you laughing at him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm interested. This was 1929, so I do wonder if his stutter was at all inspiring to Porky Pig. And I don't just mean like they both have stutters, but there's a level to his stutter where he kind of like catches himself afterwards.
Yeah.
Where he'll be like, you know, are you going to the shh? Are you going to the shh? Are you going to the theater? And like, he'll find another word to say instead of the word that he's having trouble saying. And that's very much the punchline of Porky Pig. And it kind of stemmed here, it looks like.
That's a good point. I'd be curious. I feel like I need to look up Porky Pig now.
I'm on it. You keep going.
Okay.
I have Porky Pig history speed dialed on my phone.
Perfect. So good.
It's very easy for me to pull up.
That is a really good point, though. We talked about like the origin of Bugs Bunny in Old Arizona last week or last episode. But now we have another Looney Tunes reference. Yeah, I mean, while you research that, it's just interesting to me all of the different ways the studios and the movies are utilizing sound that's not just showcasing, hey, we can talk now. When we talk next episode about Alibi, there's some really, really interesting uses of sound, really innovative ways of kind of capturing a feeling. And I'm really excited to talk about sound that way, because the two examples I've provided so far are played for laughs, and that one is more to invoke the atmosphere of the movie.
Got you. Uncle Jed is played by MGM stock player Jed Prouty. The character's pronounced stutter was a popular comic theme of the era, based on the premise of a comic struggling to find a word and ultimately settling for an easier pronounced synonym, a compensation technique occasionally employed by Porky Pig. Yeah, so it doesn't even say that it was 100% like done to it, but like they're putting the two together.
Yeah.
And in 1929, I mean, was Mel Blanc doing that? I don't think so.
No, I don't know the history of the Looney Tunes, sadly. But yeah, I guess it was less inspired by this character in particular and more of just a common trope.
Porky Pig wasn't introduced until 1935. So, I mean, this is like put in there. Yeah. And I'm not sure if Jed kind of introduced the idea of this or if this was done before. But to your point, at least in theaters, there wasn't much opportunity to do this kind of performance on film. So it is very cool to kind of see how like this lends itself to the popular era and like how it gets manifested. Just surprising that in now two episodes in a row, we found Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
Just taking it on. But isn't that cool, though? Like, if like we grew up on Looney Tunes and watching this and knowing these characters, and there's these little ticks that they have that they took from like characters in these movies.
Yeah. And it makes sense. It kind of highlights, I want to say, the cliches or the tropes of the era of the characters. Because while we're covering gangster movies like The Racket or Western movies like In Old Arizona, a lot of times those characters do feel like caricatures almost.
Sure.
And I wonder if I was to sit down and watch 10 gangster movies from 1928 or 10 Westerns from 1928, how often those particular tropes would show up as far as like characters go. And
oh, pretty often.
Yeah, I guess Mel Blanc was just like, yeah, I don't know, just use all of them.
Yeah, that's you said all of them, and I just heard that in Gary Oldman's voice in Leon the Professional.
Oh.
I can't do it in the mic, but the shouting all of them. So, that aside, I think it's really cool to see that, because I'm a big believer in, like, you know, you can't rip something off, but you can pay homage.
Yes.
And, like, you have to pay homage to, like, where you've been and the things that you've seen. And it's very cool to think that, like, Mel Blanc was specifically looking at just the surroundings and just being like, I don't know, I loved that and I loved this. And what if we did that? And what if we put this into that? And I just think that's so cool and lived in.
Yeah.
And it just feels like they are of this time.
Yes.
So not just with like cartoons and stuff, but I think that when any creator can do that and can borrow from these things, it makes them feel more real and lived in. And it also makes it feel grounded. Just in this world. Like, it's not a separate universe where these things happen. It's they've watched this stuff. And they're just like, yeah, maybe they just watched a lot of 1929 musicals. And this is just kind of what they model themselves after.
Yeah. It's so funny. We've now brought up the Muppets in an episode. And we brought up the Looney Tunes.
We have a type.
I think we're in the wrong business. Like, we should be doing the history of borderline kids media.
Whenever you do decide to jump into the deep end of the history of the Muppets, I'm way more qualified. I'm way more qualified to jump into that. So here's Beauregard, and Beauregard's job is the... Yeah, no, I wouldn't do that to you.
I mean, I would enjoy it.
Maybe that'll be a Patreon. Hey, Patreon audience, if you want to see Kyle and I get into a whole Muppets episode, whether it be the movies or the history of the Muppets, leave a comment.
Yeah. Or the Looney Tunes.
Or Looney Tunes. We'll,
that would be interesting.
We'll probably draw the line at Smurfs. I don't think we'll cover Smurfs.
No.
Not as much historical. But see, that's the thing. People will joke about it and be like, yeah, these are kids' things. And yes, we're going on this tangent. Like, those are just like kids' shows and everything. Yeah, technically. But look at like the inspiration behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Muppets essentially are a vaudeville act.
Right.
Kids are not like, ah, yes, I love vaudeville, the old days. They don't know what that is.
Yeah.
So there's so much inspiration they can take from that and give to like kids at a young age that they're not aware of. Looney Tunes, I mean, they're pulling like caricatures of people like Abbott and Costello and a number of people that kids don't know anything about. But like, there's cool history behind that. And the Smurfs and stuff like that is just like, I don't know, just you want to have fun for like 20 minutes and just turn your brain off? There's a lot of difference between the two. So I hold both Looney Tunes and Muppets in very high regard. Maybe Muppets a little bit more. That's just how I grew up.
Sure.
But yeah, that'd be such a fascinating thing to do, to talk about those and like the history behind those.
Yeah. Especially in regards to like modern cartoons and things. I wonder where they draw inspiration from.
You know what would be really cool? You can cut this out of the episode if you want to. What would be really cool is if on Christmas Day, we released an episode of us talking about the Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And like the history behind it and like what it drew inspiration from and the versions of Christmas Carol that came before it. Because Christmas Carol has been like maybe more so in like the 50s and so nominated or recognized in the Academy Awards.
Sure.
And the Muppets have kind of been like Academy Awards adjacent, like never nominated, but always like presenting. That'd be a cool little fun Patreon episode.
Yeah. That's something to look into.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll cut this.
Oh.
I think maybe the audience can start getting excited. Or not for the Muppet Christmas
this is like
Carol.
This is like that thing where you say you're going to cut it, but then I decide not to. So then there's a grassroots campaign of everyone now being like, yeah, I want to hear that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're doing it yourself, so that's not that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Give us the Muppet cut.
Everyone's like, yeah, get back to the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, so back to the Broadway Melody of 1929. You know what I really want to do? I want to watch the sequels.
Yes.
Are
they considered the sequels, though?
I have no idea. But I want to watch them. And I think I'm going to make it a goal. I'm going to make a note that when we get to those years, the Academy years, I'm going to sprinkle those in and just kind of bring them up. So when I get to the ceremony episode, I can be like, hey guys, I'm 6 years older now. And let me tell you about the Broadway Melody of 1936. And we'll probably talk about that less than we just talked about the Looney Tunes and the Muppets.
Probably.
But it'll be so worth my hour and a half of watching the Broadway Melody of 1936.
Well, to continue the cartoon talk, or at least to end it, we can't change that, Kyle, because we am who we am.
So. Oh, my God.
I did it. So let's talk a little bit about how it was received, right? So
sure.
Broadway Melody, you mentioned, was a huge success, right? Massive box office success. And I want everyone to put on their 2025 goggles when they hear this. Well, I guess earmuffs when you hear this, whatever. It made a profit of $1.6 million. So back then, amazing. Now, a bomb. But that's how things go. So you mentioned it was the top grossing picture of 1929. Very exciting to hear that in musicals. You're totally right. I speculated earlier if maybe there was some fuel or excitement for someone in the cast that kind of like brought that on. But I think you're 100% right. Having a full all-talking musical is going to get people really excited. I mean, we had a musical last year in Wicked, and look how much money that made.
Yeah.
So, all eyes on you, Wicked, for good. So, reviews were pretty great, generally positive. Basic story with some sense to it, you know, surefire moneymaker that will drag them in everywhere. Just the full expectation that, like, of course this is going to make money, and of course this is going to do well, because it is what it is.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my thought of the movie overall, is like, yeah, of course this had the success that it did, both, you know, in box office and in the Academy Awards. It's a musical. And like, it's the attempt of doing that musical, and it's supposed to have that feel-good ending that you're talking about. And I think we're kind of getting to the end here. Let's talk about that feel-good ending.
Yeah, sure. It's so weird because the plot in general, you don't like any of the male characters.
No, not at all.
They're all gross.
Eddie is kind of a jerk.
He's a big jerk.
Yeah.
He goes behind Hank's back, gets with Queenie, in like the grossest way too. He's yep. just like, yeah, your sister's fine, but boy howdy, you're better.
It's you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Queenie's so sweet the entire movie. She's like, no, I don't want to hurt my sister. I love my sister. She also gets just the worst experience with Jacques, who gets very, very forcefully aggressive with her.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie shows up to take out Jacques, doesn't, gets completely rocked by Jacques. But ultimately, the movie ends with Queenie ends up with Eddie,
mm-hmm.
her knight in shining armor, even though he's gross. And Hank continues on that that show run
yes.
that Jed was proposing to her.
The blonde that she starts working with and had the beef with earlier on is Flo, by the way.
Yes, Flo. So she ends up doing this tour with her arch rival, if you will, Flo.
Yeah.
And they head out to catch the train and start that big journey. And that's kind of how, and Queenie's back at home with Eddie, just living the, I don't know, traditional lifestyle.
Yeah, there's a moment that you feel like the movie's over mm-hmm. where Hank and Flo and Uncle Jed are leaving. And we kind of just focus a little bit more on Queenie and Eddie at their house. And then it cuts to the street and you're in a car. And you're in the car with the three that I just mentioned, Jed, Hank, and Flo. And I can't remember the last line. It wasn't anything too like prophetic. I think it actually kind of ends on like a joke line from him of like a word that he can't say. Yes. He's having trouble saying. And then it ends. And to me, that felt kind of like a fake ending. Like it felt like it probably should have wrapped on Eddie and Queenie and not try to like do one last joke at the end. But yeah. I guess that's, the, you know, they're trying to send people home laughing.
Yeah, that is weird that they...
I was kind of waiting for, like, a bigger reveal of something of, like, maybe, like, a sadness in, like, Hank's eyes or something. But it really was just, like, a punchline from Jed.
Yeah, and that goes to show, again, like, the movie is built in a way that's just feel good. And you're here for laughs. And even though Queenie has an awful moment with Jacques, lights, sound, dance,
yeah,
comedy, the end.
Yeah,
that's it.
World picks you up. I do like the line where Eddie tells Queenie to make sure the people know that it took six people to take him to throw him out of that party.
Yes. I don't like Eddie.
No. I think literally he just like, there's a similar movie that's out right now that we'll talk about in, you know, a couple months where he's being heralded. The character is being heralded and all he did was show up. Like, that's it. The dude just shows up.
Yeah.
Like, which I guess is enough sometimes. In this movie, I'm going to say it's not. Eddie's showing up in that one moment is not enough to redeem him just, like, pretty much two-timing the sisters off and on.
Yeah.
But, again, of the time. So, an interesting thing here. We're going to talk a lot about pre-code, right?
Yes.
So, do you think that this movie was affected at all by the pre-code?
Oh, that, man, that's a great thing to bring up. There's a lot of Bessie Love and Anita Page kind of in not a whole lot of clothing.
Yeah.
That's
essentially what they call like their like undergarments while they're like brushing their teeth.
Right, yeah. And even Queenie's in the bathtub at one point.
Yeah.
You know, from shoulders up, but still pretty risque for old Hollywood. I know pre-code is a completely different ballgame, but we're gonna kind of heading into that code era. So this is all gonna go away.
Yep.
It's always, I wonder how much that affected the box office, you know?
Well, if it was the highest grossing at the time, I can't imagine it capped it too much, right? Like people kind of want to see the salaciousness mm-hmm. of it. But I think, you know, that goes the complete opposite way of what musicals tend to be. It's not always salacious. It's more like the joyful, happy experience. And I ask that question because it feels like there's something between not just the love triangle, but like the character of Eddie and the character of Jacques and the things that happen in this that feel very much a pre-code. Then when the code does come in, they dance around this topic a lot more delicately.
Right.
And that's the Hollywood that we've come to know in like the 40s and 50s in the way that they depict these relationships.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like if you were to show this movie to someone that doesn't normally watch older films, they would be shocked at the level of certain things you see, like Jacques' advancements on Queenie and things.
Yep.
And as you said, you get to the 40s and the 50s, and that's more of what you'd expect being in the code era.
Well, I think specifically about like relationships on camera. And if you think of like, you know, your Roman Holidays, like there's a romance element to it that is a lot more innocent than it is in these scenarios. It's a little more gritty, I guess. I would not say that Broadway Melody is gritty, but in comparison to those, I'd say maybe a little bit more edgy, I guess, yeah, is the word for it. But specifically, there's something about it that feels very raw, mm-hmm, that, without feeling that dangerous.
You're referring to the Roman Holiday feels raw, or
no, sorry, no, that there's more in the Broadway Melody that feels like kind of like a rawness to that idea.
See. Yeah,
where it's more fabricated, but we've embraced that fabrication later on of like, that's not how love is, but like, that's what we want love to be.
Right.
Whereas this, it feels kind of like that is actually how love is. It's messy. It's like dangerous. It's weird.
Yeah.
But the way it's portrayed here just doesn't paint people in the best light, i.e. Eddie.
Right. And I think when the code is enacted, you get to movies showing these same themes, but they have to be creative in how they present them.
Totally.
So in this, it's like, Jacques made an advancement, and that is what you're going to see.
Yeah.
Adultery or whatever, and that's exactly what we're going to show you.
Yeah.
Still, you know, to a very, I don't know, modest audience, I guess, but you're still seeing it just blatant.
One thing I'm really excited for in the coming weeks and months is that you mentioned there's a lot of remakes, right? Sequels, whatever it might be, even the Broadway Melody of 1930, whichever ones they were.
Hmm.
So there's a time where these movies that are being remade after the code, right? So there's pre-code and then post-code or mid-code. So I'm very interested in going back and watching these movies and discussing them with you in terms of how they compare to their pre-code counterparts, because that's going to show directly what they did not think was acceptable for the Hollywood image at that time.
Yeah. Pre-code is a whole genre in itself that I'd want to dive more into.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking about it now with the Broadway Melody, and this is very tame compared to what some other pre-code films are. But you're right. I'm excited to see the remakes specifically and how they present some of the same themes and topics in a kind of skirting the line way.
Right. I mean, we talked about it off pod, but I picked up a Criterion of His Girl Friday. And that, of course, is going to make its way to the Academy Awards in its respective year. But it came with a bonus Blu-ray disc, which, I mean, Criterion's giving away bonus Blu-rays is just, you know, God's work. Thank you. They are, go listen to our Lost Media episode. They included the pre-code version of that movie, the original version, which is the front page.
Right.
So it's going to be very interesting for us to do our research, which, again, that is also going to be in the talks when we get to the year, I think it's 1931,
yep,
where it is nominated. So we will have the ability, and on this podcast, to like have an episode where we do talk about these pre-code films and then their counterparts later on that were affected by the code. So it's interesting to see how that breaks up.
Yeah, I think that is not only our first example of pre-code to code remake, but just remake in general. So that's going to be a fun two episodes spaced like a year apart, I think.
Maybe we'll do a Patreon episode after the His Girl Friday episode where we kind of like split the two.
Yeah.
And talk about those specifically.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think they fall in the same year. I think 31 and 40 will end in the same like calendar year.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So that'll be cool.
I was going to say, I know you're wrong. Like it's like right. 9 years between the two movies, but yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. As far as the show goes.
Yeah.
I want to bring up two real quick things and then we can get into ratings. We didn't mention the studio that produced this. It's MGM.
Yes.
Funny enough, the last film we're talking about for this round of the Oscars, also an MGM production, also partly a musical, The Hollywood Review of 1929.
Mm-hmm.
So two big MGM musicals, and that's kind of what MGM is come to be known as, the musical studio. So that'll be fun to talk about in regards to just MGM pumping out musicals around this time period.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to bring up is Arthur Freed was head of music in this movie. And while we didn't have a ton of praise for the music other than the Broadway Melody, he later goes on to do music for some big films that we'll be covering on the show, An American in Paris and Gigi. So big names attached to this movie that we are going to talk about more in depth later. Just didn't add a whole lot to the discussion today.
Well, I mean, that's what I think is really interesting about this is that we kind of see the beginning of these people, right?
Yeah.
Like the beginning of what they're fully capable of. Because I'm a big believer that you kind of have to like go through it to like fully experience it. And like, in order to manage something, you have to like go through all the steps below so you know what you're managing. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, being involved in these movies and being nominated, that's awesome. But you have to go through it to really like find what you truly want to do. And it makes sense that there's things that Arthur Freed does later on that make a little bit more of an impact than it did here.
Yeah. And this movie could have been the catalyst for all of these people to go on and do bigger projects. We didn't mention this, but this is the Outstanding Picture winner of this year. So that alone could be the entire reason we have An American in Paris.
That's true. I understand what you're saying now. I honestly thought like you meant like there's an American correspondent in Paris right now. And I was like, just one?
Yeah, but we don't talk about him. It's top secret.
Good luck, bud. Mm-hmm. Jacques.
Oh, God, I hope not. I almost spit out my coffee.
We do not want Jacques to represent us.
Anybody.
Over there.
I don't want him to represent anybody. Let's talk about ratings now,
though. Yeah. I've gotten better about Letterboxd. This is not a joke. I every time I feel like I'm going to say this. I was talking with someone the other day, and they asked for my Letterboxd account, and I gave it to them. And then the next day that I saw them, they said, you got to get your numbers up, dog.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is the worst. Like, that's an offensive thing that you just said to me. But, I mean, he's right, and the problem is that for the longest time using Letterboxd, I didn't know that you had to, like, do anything other than, like, put the star review and then press done. Mm. You have to, like, review and log.
Yes.
And that way people can see it.
And you get your nice diary.
Yeah, exactly. And so then I'm going back, and I'm like, there are so many movies that I have seen that I don't have on my diary because I haven't reviewed and logged them.
Yep.
I just put the star. So, disappointing. I promise I'm a cinema head. But so, point is, I'm doing that now. Like, very, very regularly doing that. So, for the Broadway Melody, I did think about how we talked about how we wanted to rate these, mm-hmm. right? And I think that for the achievement of what it's done and how it birthed this idea of what musicals can, should, and do ultimately become to be, I wanted to give it a lot of credit.
Okay.
But as an enjoyment factor, I can't say that I enjoyed my time with this movie that much. Mm-hmm. There's aspects that come and go. There's moments where I was kind of expecting, like, you know, they go and have a musical number, and I'm like, hit me like White Christmas. Like, hit me right now with something that's just like a tearjerker, just like a great musical number, and then we get back to the story. And it's just kind of, there is a musical number, but it's not going to resonate with you the way that other musicals later on tend to do. So I ultimately landed on a 2.5.
Okay.
2.5 stars for me on this one. It's not a bad movie by any means. It's just, it kind of meanders a little bit for a while. Like you said, the narrative is extremely thin, and it does go on for an hour and 40 minutes. It does make it feel a bit longer than it should be.
Right.
I think technically in Old Arizona was just about as long, and that flew by for me.
Yes, I agree. We're going to keep up the trend of your reviews being higher than mine.
Mm.
This did change from when I originally watched it. Like I said, I don't know what I was feeling that day, but I was like, the Broadway Melody.
You were doing the dance, I remember.
Yeah, but this time it kind of fell flat with me. I would say the highlight of this movie beyond that one musical hook that I've now sang like 6 times, which is probably the same amount that Eddie does in the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Beyond that, and Bessie Love having some really fun dialogue, little quips. I wish I could remember any of them. Beyond that, this movie's not great for me. It's sing its praises for it being the first and all of that, but as far as entertainment goes, I am giving it a 2 stars. 2 star, jeez.
Yeah.
No, there's stars. Anyway. Yeah.
There's plural.
I really want to make that spreadsheet of our ratings because it's so funny to me that your ratings are all higher than mine.
I think the problem is that you've been here before. And I'm like, I want to give you credit for like what you've done here, but I do want to make sure you know that I didn't like the movie that much.
Right.
And you're just like, nah, dog, that's a no from me.
I'm like, Ryan, you should come on this podcast and talk old movies and open your mind to what these movies provide for us
mm-hmm.
on an intellectual level. Also, I don't like these movies.
Also, they suck.
I'm glad you are enjoying them. Hey, that brings up a good point, though. These are like the first musical, the first Western filmed outdoors,
yeah.
And all of that, first. Next year, we're not going to be able to say that anymore. So we can't use that as a kind of like a crutch to alter our feelings on the movie.
That's where the 1 stars come out.
You think that's going to start happening?
I mean, realistically.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm sure if I know myself well enough, what's going to happen, and you guys can quote me on this, is that next year, next month, I'm going to be a little bit meaner, but mostly just be like, you know what? It's still early on. You guys are still figuring it out. I get it.
Right.
When we get to 1935, I'm like, you know better. Like, yeah. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? One star. So we'll see. But I want to grade these the way that I think of, like, you know, a miserable experience. Mm-hmm. And if I'm rating anything a 0.5, it must have been like threatening to kill my family. Like, right. Just what is it doing?
Yes.
So, and don't get me wrong, I've seen movies that have made me feel like it's threatening to kill my family. So yeah. I have rated things 0.5. So I will. We'll see. But right now it's still, it's there. It's fun. It's enjoyable. It's really nice to have on in the background, but it's not great.
Yeah.
So I probably would be happily live in the 2 to 2.5 stars review yes. that we have given it.
Yeah, because like you said, none of these movies are bad.
Yeah, not yet.
I've not had a bad experience. Even if these weren't the first of their kind, they're fine.
Yeah.
So.
And it's not even the movie that I like the least that we will talk about for this month.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. That being said, that covers everything we have to say about the Broadway Melody of 1929, at least. Stay tuned for the sequels.
Do you want to talk about Paired?
Oh, yes, yes. I almost forgot. Oh, I've got to think.
Do you want me to go first so you can think?
No, yes, please, okay. If you go first.
I'm not going to tell you anything that isn't going to be surprising, but everything that I wanted Broadway Melody to be, it reminded me of these things in the moment. And it reminded me of, what about this, like, great love triangle? What about this great idea of standing up for your person? What about this great idea of, like, these musical numbers that just completely, like, blow out everything out of the water? Stop for a moment and just do these things. And I'm thinking of two movies, and I'm legitimately trying to decide in real time between the two.
Okay.
I will tell you my White Christmas.
Okay.
White Christmas for me, I think, is the one where you really need to try and, like, have the male counterpart shown as he has humility. And there's no part of Eddie that has that humility. But the humility is brought out by the two lead characters of White Christmas. And you have this really interesting, like, dynamic. It's not necessarily a love triangle, but love dynamic between Bing Crosby and the two other leads. Actually, George Clooney's mom is in that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She's one of the... I need to go back. I need to prepare these so I can say names and everything, but she is one of the leads in White Christmas. And just going back to it, like, it felt like that was a movie that, like, did not mind having the drama and the comedy, and then being like, hey, by the way, almost like a variety show, here's our musical. And then just, like, they do a musical and the colors pop. And it doesn't even make sense that they were able to film this on, like, location at this cabin in, like, Vermont. Mm-hmm. But they do it anyways because it's a musical and you can. And everything that I wanted Broadway Melody to be, and the notes that I wanted to hit, I saw the moments where they were like, wow, what if we did this pop of color? What if we had this romance? What if we had this, like, number that just completely changed the way that people thought about musicals? That's what White Christmas did. So granted, White Christmas isn't going to exist without something like Broadway Melody, but I think that's a really good pairing to kind of see, like, how it should have started, or how it started and what they wanted to do, and how we got to a point where we could do those things a little bit more effectively.
Mm, I like it.
But also handle the idea of, like, you know, there's a lot of toxic masculinity inside of Eddie and Jock.
Yes.
And I think there's some masculinity that's a bit toxic in White Christmas that is immediately kind of, like, put on display and spotlight and kind of made fun of a little bit by the male counterpart to Bing Crosby's character. So there's, like, a little bit of, like, delight in, like, them still kind of showcasing that toxicity.
Okay. I've never seen White Christmas.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it up until, like, 4 years ago. And then when I did, it was kind of just like, oh, I've missed out. Mm. Just, I mean, I think Christmas is December is a perfect time to watch musicals. So for me, that just felt like the perfect combination of, like, Christmas, musical, but could be a classic. You could watch it anytime. Bing Crosby and his actions aside.
Right. Yeah, I think this is going to be the year then that I watch White Christmas.
Yeah.
I probably won't
you do come the back double and you're feature. Like, I like Broadway Melody more.
Yeah.
Melody.
Man, I was really trying to think of a good double feature, and I should have prepared for this. I'm definitely preparing before the next episode, but I think...
I mean, I gave you a freebie.
Yeah, but I'm not taking it.
Good for you.
I can do it myself. I'm going to go with Moulin Rouge.
Oh, yeah.
The love triangle in that is kind of weird because nobody really wants part of that whole isosceles.
Yeah.
But it's a later musical, early 2000s. I really enjoy the music in that, so can't really compare it to the Broadway Melody.
The risque nature of Broadway Melody lends itself to like the full risque element of Moulin Rouge.
Sure, yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know, this feels kind of like a shallow double feature. I just picked another musical that I like that has a love triangle.
Well, you know, I think I always like to find the connection beyond that because, yeah, you can't just say two musicals. That's kind of what I did. But you got to find the things between that make them like linked a little bit more. And for you, I mean, there's like, again, there's a risque nature to like, oh, look, they're in their very not revealing at all undergarments in this. Isn't that crazy?
Right.
And then how we kind of embraced the element of like the more sexy style of musicals like Moulin Rouge. So there's an interesting dynamic there.
Yeah. And Moulin Rouge does follow the story of them putting on a big performance and all of that. And kind of the background of creating that stage performance or whatever, that stage play, influencing the relationships of the characters. Mm. So that's what I've got.
Smart. I like it.
It's something. Yeah, I think that's going to do it for this episode. We're running a little bit long, which is surprising for the Broadway Melody. If you'd like to support the show, follow us on patreon.com/OUTAO podcast. And if you would like to write into the show and give us your thoughts and feelings on musicals in general or the Broadway Melody or any other movie that we're covering on the show, shoot us an email at OUTAOpodcast@gmail.com. We'll read those on the ceremony episodes. And social media, you can follow us there. The links will be in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Once Upon a Time at the Oscars on most things.
Yeah.
OUTAO podcast on other things. And I think that's it.
That's it.
Next episode, we'll be covering Alibi, another early gangster film.
Two more episodes of this Oscar year before we get to our ceremony.
Yep. Hope you're looking forward to that. Hope you're watching the movies along with us. A quick reminder, if you want to watch these early films, you can head over to the Once Upon a Time at the Oscars YouTube page, and I've saved a list of all of these movies that you can watch on YouTube with the correct soundtrack and scores.
Yeah, he looked directly in my eyes as he said that, by the way.
I did. So check us out there. But that's going to do it for this week's episode. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll
see you at the movies.